3.
The gang rape of the young woman in December in India was a catalyst for what has become a mass movement.
2.
The real solution to both the fiscal cliff dilemma and the economic crisis as a whole is to seize the banks.
1.
This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm Ernesto Aguilar. This edition of the program, just as Congress appears to have reached a deal on the fiscal cliff crisis, forces are mobilizing for what is expected to be a bruising showdown over spending on social services. But first, two brutal sexual assaults have made international headlines and brought to the forefront issues of rape culture and the largely ignored matter of murder, abuse, and dehumanization of women. New Delhi, India, and Steubenville, Ohio, may be thousands of miles apart, but the cases seem eerily familiar. Both women repeatedly gang-raped, allegations of official cover-ups, and mass protests demanding justice. In India, a struggle led by women seeking the prosecution of the men who raped and killed a 23-year-old woman has brought to light the horrifying numbers of sexual assaults in New Delhi. As details of the case have been broadcast, even high-profile Indians have spoken out. Here's one of the country's most popular Bollywood celebrities, actress Kareena Kapoor, speaking to reporters.
Cases are going on since 2004, my Aaj paper. That they have not found the victims of those cases. So, jo kal hua hai, I mean, we don't know when justice is going to happen. So, our government needs to reassess our justice laws to encourage that to happen faster. By saying a woman should not go out at night is not the solution to this problem.
In Steubenville, Ohio, football players are accused of dragging a 16-year-old girl from location to location to be raped. A growing movement is saying these incidents are the case of a system that fails to recognize women's human rights. Natalie Hreese of Women Organized to Resist and Defend joins the program via telephone to discuss the cases and assess the needed response. Natalie, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you.
Maybe we can set the stage to talk about these two particular incidents and your opinion of how this has unfolded.
What we've seen is two very different incidents, and they've unfolded in really different ways. The gang rape of the young woman in December in India was a catalyst for what has become a mass movement in India, but is being looked at internationally. And I think what's really important about it is that what happened was horrific, but it also isn't uncommon. The violence against women in India and around the world is really commonplace in many ways. And then the series of events afterwards in terms of no repercussions and the authority figures completely ignoring it, almost condoning these very severe acts of violence, spark what has become a very strong resistance and widespread movement with demonstrations of families and students and workers and men and women, and has changed the landscape in India. And there is some accountability being carried out, and the way the demonstrations are being led and the movement is being built is that it's not stopping there. It's stepped a little, but it continues and has inspired people around the world to really resist it. In Steubenville, I think we saw something very similar, which was, again, a horrific crime carried out against a very young woman that then was covered up and ignored and condoned, and we're seeing the same thing in a different way, but people are very upset about it and responding to it, and protests are occurring and the connections being made. And I think what we're witnessing because of these two incidences, which for, you know, whatever reason have sparked these movements and these protests, is that it's bringing to light the issue of violence against women and really asking the world what it's going to do about an issue that is not isolated to one city in India or isolated to a small town, but is really a widespread societal problem. And the way the media has covered it is to really responds to the movement. You know, the movement has forced the media to cover these things, but it's been very mixed. It's not like the media is completely on the side of any movement for, you know, ending violence against women. And a lot of the things that are said in, about women and about rape are just repeated over and over again in a way that doesn't create the sort of situation in which these problems can really be addressed.
This type of incident that we've seen in India, as well as the incident that we've seen in Steubenville, oftentimes you had treated as these isolated kind of things, but the world is now starting to understand that perhaps this is a conversation we need to be having on a broader scale about violence against women. Could you talk about that? Because I think oftentimes people treat this, as you pointed out, as this bad apples issue or bad people doing bad things, when in fact, globally, we have a very significant issue with violence against women, trafficking of women, abuse of women, just disrespect of women's human rights.
I think we face a situation where in the United States and in many countries around the world, women are treated as objects. They're treated as commodities. Because of that, the violence carried out against them, which just I'm most familiar with our situation in the United States. And if you look at just a few of the statistics from the last couple of years, that a quarter of women who are in college experience attempted rape or rape. One in five women will experience rape. And that's just rape. I mean, violence against women, when you start to sort of open the definition of that, you're looking at abuse at the hands of a partner, which is extremely common, where you're looking at young women and how they're treated on the streets and harassed. I mean, violence runs the gamut of these things, and it's pervasive. I think that's the key, is that it is not sort of just the acts of the young football players and then the few people around them who covered it up, or the group of men in Delhi and then the authorities who refused to investigate, investigated poorly, also covered it up. It's really an issue of the way that society is organized that condones this kind of treatment of women as objects and commodities, and not just condones it, propagates it in the images that are put out or the way women are discussed or the way politicians talk about women. So we have Scott Aitken's use of the word forcible rape a year ago. And I think one of the things that has come out is things like the issue of Facebook, this young woman who started an argument with a site or a page on Facebook that makes humor out of rape, you know, as if it was a joke, the kind of violence that's carried out against women. And because of her opposition, her arguments with them, they posted a picture of her Photoshop to be bruised, and Facebook refused to take it down. They were asked four times to take it down, and they didn't take it down, and they haven't apologized. And they're part of a consortium of social network media and other corporations that run the media that think it's okay to joke about rape and don't see it as a real issue and think women should just have to deal with it. And that points to this kind of larger issue of the society and the way it treats this issue.
I've noticed in following some of the case in New Delhi, there has been a lot more involvement of society as a whole in condemning what's happened and in speaking out. However, here in the United States, popular culture seems oftentimes very much structured around this idea that rape is a joke. I don't know if you think that some of the larger cultural and political and economic discourse in this country contributes to this dehumanization of women.
I would say absolutely. I mean, I kind of have two points to make on that. One is, I do want to bring up the fact that Congress has not reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act, which was an act that was passed in 1994 and had its own problems and everything like that, but it was a step in the direction of really taking some sort of measures about violence against women and recognizing it. And the Congress has not reauthorized it, which has never happened before. But this Congress and the one before it, we've witnessed an attack one after another. I mean, literally hundreds of legislative pieces, not only in the Congress, that's the federal legislature, but in state ones as well, hundreds more, that are constant either outright bills to reduce or inhibit a woman's right to make decisions about her body and her birth control and all that, but also doing things like not continuing legislation that already exists or getting rid of it to protect women. And that is absolutely contributes to a society in which the general sort of tone or discussion about women, based on that kind of political discourse, inculcates the kind of things we're talking about. The issue of using rape as humor or of belittling women and that being okay. The other point I wanted to make is I think, and this goes back to the first question too, is kind of all of this can be very depressing and you can say, okay, we live in a society where women can be talked about in a certain way from social media to the corporate media to the Congress, and it feels like there's not a whole lot you can do about it. And that's totally untrue. I think there is a way to change that and to put a stop to the way that women are talked about and the way they're treated, and that's really building a movement. And you can see how in just a few weeks in India, the kind of movement that came out into the streets in an organized way, but also a very powerful way, has had that effect in starting to change the way people behave in response to violence against women, and also the way they talk about women, and completely change the discussion going on. And I think that's also what is necessary here. We do need an organized movement that can say, it's not okay. It is not okay to speak about women that way. It's not okay to let the Violence Against Women Act go. It's also not enough. Like, we need a new one that's more powerful, that's stronger, and really stand up for women's rights and for ending the violence against women.
I was noticing on Facebook recently that there were a number of major media outlets that were talking about how important it is for an overall social discussion that doesn't blame women for violence that is committed against them. Do you feel like movements are responsible for helping push that discourse in a completely important and positive direction?
Yeah. I mean, that's the short answer, is absolutely. I'm not old enough to have witnessed the women's movement of primarily the 70s, also I think in the late 60s, that was a militant and very mass women's movement that was able to win some of the gains that we're fighting to defend and fighting to win back, like the Roe v. Wade decision, and even the decisions that were made in the decades following that. But I think one thing that I know from speaking to people who were in that movement is that you couldn't talk about women during that period anywhere. Even the most right-wing, it was hard to get away with talking about women the way you can now. And I think the fact that there is a women's movement, and we need a stronger one, we need one that can push farther, but any women's movement can be a powerful factor in changing that and really pushing it forward. And I think social media can also play a role as a reflection of that and being present on that and speaking out in ways that were maybe not possible during the militant mass movement of the 70s.
Do you have any assessments of some of the critiques that I have noticed online about some of the post-feminist movements that have emerged?
One thing, the sort of baseline, is what's necessary and what's needed is a movement. And we need women to stand up and say no. We need women to come out in the streets, and not just women, but men and, you know, everyone in society really to stand up and understand this issue and be part of that movement. And that movement is going to have many different forces in it and many different people participating in it. And I think those kind of debates are going to happen. And within the women's movement, there will be disagreements, and there are, on how to best build and speak to each other. I think things that try to own, the word slut, which is used as an insult and has always been used as an insult, will be challenged, because you can't kind of reclaim that word. Like, that's a word used to put women down. It's a word used to be aggressive and harassing towards women. And I think women are better served, and the movement is better served, by really saying, like, we don't accept this. We don't accept violent discussions of women. We don't accept being insulted. We reject it. And in the place of it, we demand to be treated with respect. And I think the sort of contradiction within some of the things we've seen in, like, the slut walk and some of the other elements is that they're saying that, but it's under the cover of also sort of trying to reclaim a word that's not really reclaimable. But I do think that it's a good thing for women to be standing up, and it's a good thing for women to be coming out and talking about the different aspects of how they're treated, the words that are used, but also the other elements to it. Because the thing is that the way women are treated is not just an issue of, you know, sometimes it gets pigeonholed into reproductive rights or the right to abortion or violence against women. And I think what we can see when we really look at the issue is that it's broad. It's the issue of payment of our wages being lower than men. For white women, it's 22 cents less than men, white men, but for you know, women of color, for African American women, Latino women, and other women of color, it's even lower, this connection between the racism and sexism that occurs in society. There's the issue of education, which is very much an issue of women's rights. You know, as a mother myself, I'm struggling to figure out how to put my kid into school. And that's an issue of women and their families, issue of poverty. You know, so I think it's a very, it's like something that needs to come up. We have to have this discussion. We have to have the organizing. And it needs to focus in on particular issues. And it also needs to make the connection.
That very real type of conversation is sometimes, I think, socially we have a very difficult time with, just understanding that economically, if women remain disenfranchised, if women are not paid equally, those struggles continue to happen. And we only reinforce the idea of women's inferiority when we refuse to pay an equal wage, when there is not respect for reproductive rights, there's not respect for a lot of different things that oftentimes, I think, get pigeonholed into a feminist movement, but speak to a much larger issue.
It's a question of the way that society is organized. I mean, I think if you really get into the questions of women's oppression and fighting back against it, you also have to raise the issue of how society is organized, because there are so many elements to the way that women are treated unequally or violently. Society is organized in such a way that people, not just women, but people in a lot of ways are commodified. That in order to really win true equality, what steps need to be taken? What do we need? And we need to fight for the most basic reforms and in the most basic struggles, because we have to. As women and as part of the society, we should have full reproductive rights, and that's totally and completely winnable. But we also have to look to organizing society in a way that childcare, that education, that housing, that the way wages are paid are all questions for us, because those are all issues that pertain to winning full equality. So I think you're absolutely right. Like, the movement has to take up these questions of economics, of society, of its organization.
Coming back to these two cases that we began the discussion about, what to you has been the most inspiring thing about seeing these movements grow?
I do have one thing that, just in reading and seeing, when there was a sign I saw that, to me, was an important sign to see grown up in this society and not even kind of recognizing, you know, the violence or the harassment that happens in our own daily lives until really entering the movement and becoming an organizer. There was a sign that a man was carrying in India that just said, rape is everyone's issue. And I thought that was a really important political statement, that rape, and not just rape, but the treatment of women, the violence against women, is an issue for everyone. And it's an issue of improving the way we all live to end these kind of acts and to end the way women are treated and then the way it's condoned. And I think that was sort of a moment that was very inspiring. But in general, it's inspiring to see that people are struggling against and winning some things and continuing to struggle against something that is sometimes just considered that's the way it is. Like, well, there is violence against women. These things do happen. You just have to be safer, or you have to do certain things to take care of yourself. And instead, it seems there's a kind of opening for us to say no. And that's inspired by the opening that was created in India and in what's kind of popping up around the world, you know, an ability to say it's not the way it is and it's not the way it should be. And we can really sink our teeth into that and organize the resistance to that. And it can be widespread. It can reach out to many different sectors of society, and men and women and all people can really participate in it.
How should men be participating in these movements, in your opinion?
The organization WORD, which I'm a part, Women Organized to Resist and Defend, has kind of put out, since we started in this last year, the idea that what we need to do is build the movement in a variety of different ways. And, you know, we've had demonstrations. We had demonstrations in August and in October that had different characters. And it was during the election season, so we were really speaking about holding both Democrats and Republicans accountable. And now we're moving into a period where, you know, the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade is coming, where International Women's Day is coming in March 8th. And I think we need to find the women who, and men, and everyone who are interested in this struggle and in building it, and in coming out into the street in a very visible way, and also, you know, talking to their friends and family and coworkers and co-students, and really building a mass movement. I think that's what's needed to push the struggle forward and to make some of the gains we need in society. It can look all sorts of different ways when people do that. Many people come out to a demonstration sometimes for their first sort of activity, and they participate, and they march or they rally, and they hear it, and they watch it, and they see it, and that's part of it. That's a step. And people also come to meetings, and they start doing outreach, and they think about those things, and you know, there's all sorts of different ways in which people take some action, and I think it's very valid, it's very important. And we forget sometimes in this society that that kind of action is important, and that it can be done, and that it's very accessible, and that we can all play some role. So I think it is an important point.
As we wind things down, I was wondering if you had any other thoughts you'd like to share with listeners.
I guess I'd just like to encourage anyone who is listening to get involved, and to know that there are things happening, particularly in the United States, in terms of trying to organize in our communities and across the country to stand up against violence against women, to also stand for reproductive rights, to really build a movement for women's rights, and not just against what is happening to us, but also for what we need. And they should definitely check out WORD, Women Organize to Resist and Defend, which has a website, defendwomensrights.org. But I think that's the biggest thing, is to get involved, to take that step in whatever way you can.
Natalie Hreese is an educator and activist with Women Organized to Resist and Defend. Visit the organization online at defendwomensrights.org.
Like Liberation Radio? You are encouraged to give a positive rating and review on iTunes and Stitcher. A few minutes of your time helps improve the program's visibility and is really appreciated. And you can learn more about people speaking up for global change. Donate and join the effort on pslweb.org.
Walter Smolarek joins the program via Skype to talk about the fiscal cliff debate and the stakes for workers. His piece in Liberation newspaper examines the negotiations as well as the entitlement battles anticipated to happen in March. The media's focus seems largely on taxes, the Obama administration, and burdens faced by the so-called job creators. We began our conversation with Walter remarking how the fiscal cliff debate seems somehow familiar.
This is definitely not the first time that the ruling class in the United States has used this sort of like crisis, like apocalyptic rhetoric to try to force through cuts to vital social programs that poor and working people rely on. This current fiscal cliff drama really began in the summer of 2011. Since like 1917, about once a year, Congress has to increase what's called like the debt ceiling, which is, you know, the limit that the federal government can borrow up to. And I think it's, you know, something enormous, like $16 trillion. For the last 95 years or something, it had been like a relatively drama-free affair. But in, you know, 2011, the U.S. ruling class, and especially the Republican Party, decided to go on the offensive. And so they said, you know, we will not raise the debt ceiling. And, you know, the consequences of that could be, you know, the potential default of the United States government on its debt. So we will not raise the debt ceiling unless this so-called out of control spending is reined in. And by that they meant, you know, cutting Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, food stamps, you know, other things that poor and working people rely on. There were a few months of negotiations. There's this great debt ceiling crisis. You know, all the news stations had like these little countdown clocks on their scroller. What ended up happening was that they passed what's called the Budget Control Act of 2011. Under the Budget Control Act, they basically gave themselves a deadline, which was, you know, conveniently after the 2012 election. So it was, you know, New Year's 2012 or New Year's Day 2013 to come up with a deal to cut the deficit by $1.2 trillion over the next 10 years. And so that's sort of like where this, you know, latest fiscal cliff drama came from. It's the same rhetoric all the time. Social Security is in crisis, you know, entitlement spending, you know, the euphemism for these social programs. It's in crisis, you know, it's out of control. And if we don't rein it in, then, you know, the country could go bankrupt or, you know, absurdities like that. And they never look at any solution other than cutting the things that poor and working class people need. And that really betrays, you know, the class program of both the Democratic and the Republican Party. countries.
You pointed out in your article about how this seemed to be just an effort by not just Republicans, because I think oftentimes the media narrative is one of Republicans holding Congress hostage, but in which Democrats were not just actors, but very active participants in some of these issues. Could you outline that a bit?
We heard a lot of sort of like left liberal commentators in the run up to the fiscal cliff deal and immediately afterwards sort of lament about how the Democrats are like bad negotiators, essentially. I think that's misleading because the Democratic Party is in fact completely in line with this ideology of cut social spending, increase taxes for poor and working people. There might be a little bit of a difference in how, you know, the Republican and Democratic parties approach the matter. You know, the Republicans might be a little bit more bold, and the Democrats might want to have some really petty minor increases on taxes for rich people to try to make it more palatable to their base. But really, both are completely in line with the idea that entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, particularly in addition to other programs, need to be cut. You never heard hardly any Democrats, certainly not President Obama, contesting that basic logic that, you know, these social programs need to be cut. The most direct evidence of this that we have is the Simpson-Bowles Commission. So the Simpson-Bowles Commission was set up in, I believe, 2010, and it was basically this panel of politicians handpicked by President Obama. It was supposedly, you know, centrist and, you know, bipartisan or nonpartisan. Its task was to come up with a plan for reducing the deficit. And what they came up with was essentially the Republicans' bargaining positions. And this is something that, you know, the Democrats and President Obama wholeheartedly supported. Raise the retirement age, which is something that's completely possible over the next couple months. Cut spending for, you know, healthcare for older workers. And basically just devastate all these things that people rely on, especially in periods of crisis and mass unemployment like the one that we're in right now. I want to read something from President Obama's victory address. After he won the election in November, he said to the best campaign team and volunteers in the history.
To the best campaign team and volunteers in the history of politics. The best ever. Some of you were new this time around, and some of you have been at my side since the very beginning. But all of you are family. No matter what you do or where you go from here, you will carry the memory of the history we made together. And you will have the lifelong appreciation of a grateful president. Thank you for believing all the way to every hill, to every valley. You lifted me up the whole way, and I will always be grateful for everything that you've done and all the incredible work that you've put in.
There's obviously a little bit of election night hyperbole in that statement, but it's not, you know, that much of an exaggeration. Like, you know, the president had a very, very effective ground game for his reelection campaign. Those millions of people, that army of volunteers that he relied on, those people didn't just vanish after election day. There is still this like massive apparatus of support that, you know, the president and the Democratic Party, organizations whose leadership is unfortunately tied to the Democratic Party, like the AFL-CIO leadership, if they mobilize their base, it's not an exaggeration to say that there could have been hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people on the streets all across the country. And that would have decisively changed the course of negotiations, of the so-called negotiations in Washington. But they didn't do that because both the Republicans and the Democrats are ultimately accountable not to poor and working people in the United States, but to the Wall Street corporate interests, you know, the capitalist interests that really run this country.
Do you think that's why the left has spared the Obama administration so much in this particular discussion? Because so many of them have tied their fortunes to whether the Democratic Party wins or loses.
I think that's a fair assessment. Unfortunately, the leadership of a lot of mass organizations, particularly in the labor movement, have sort of followed this lesser of two evils strategy that I think this even more decisively than, you know, the experience, some experiences of the last few decades prove that that's a losing strategy. You know, it's one of demobilization and demoralization and, you know, a constant backsliding to the right that we've seen since the 1970s.
Where do you see these conversations going in March? First of all, for listeners, can you talk about what will happen in March and your assessment based on your reading of events?
There wasn't this sort of like grand bargain that a lot of people were talking about between Speaker of the House Boehner and the Democrats. There was essentially a deal on taxation, which is one half of the fiscal cliff deal. And then they basically postponed negotiations and the deal in terms of spending for the next 2 months. So that's going to also coincide with the next sort of like debt ceiling, right? And that's something that's going to happen every year or so. Essentially, what we can expect there is the Republicans saying, we gave you all these things supposedly in terms of the tax deal. And there were, you know, a few mildly progressive measures in the tax bill, like increasing the capital gains tax very modestly from, you know, 15 to 20%, a tiny increase on the top income bracket from 35% to 39.6% when it comes to the income tax. So basically, now that the Democrats, who are, you know, the supposed defenders of poor and working people, have given up all this leverage, the supposed leverage that they would have used to defend our interests, there is going to be basically no stopping, you know, the onslaught of cuts to very important programs that people rely on to retire with dignity, that people rely on to meet outrageously high medical bills. And it's likely that even a wider range of programs will come under attack. The federal Pell Grant is one of them, food stamps, lots and lots of other things that working people have won through years of struggle. It wasn't given to us, but now that the ruling class in the United States sees an opening, they're going to use this crisis, this manufactured crisis, to try to roll back.
You've observed the coverage of the fiscal cliff debate. What do you feel was the most misreported or underreported story of the entire affair?
I don't know if this is necessarily the most misreported, but one thing that I think is really important to remember is that before the deal was cut, you know, the final deal was voted on, the Democratic Party politicians postured as, you know, defenders of, quote, 98% of Americans, right? They said, you know, we'll only increase taxes on 2% of, work, you know, the richest 2% of people who are in those, you know, high income brackets. And what actually happened is that they raised taxes on 77% of working people, 77% of taxpayers. And they did that by letting the reduction in the Social Security contribution tax expire. So now, instead of contributing 4.2% of your wages to the Social Security fund, workers now have to contribute 6.2%. So while that might seem like a small increase for, you know, poor and working people in the middle of a very intense economic crisis with no end in sight, that's a very significant blow to the financial stability of a lot of working class families. And in fact, some of the numbers are difficult to understand. You know, statistics are very political, but, you know, some estimates say that the majority of the $620 billion in revenue that the taxation deal raises is actually from working class people through the increase in the Social Security contribution tax. So that's, I think, sort of like a very hidden story and really exposes how duplicitous the Democrats are.
I want to go back to something you just said because I want to draw this out for listeners, and I think it's an important point. Statistics are political. What do you mean?
The capitalist class can line up 1,000 economists with PhDs to tell us whatever they want to tell us. They can tell us that, you know, the economy is recovering. They can tell us that unemployment is decreasing or that this will reduce the deficit or whatever they want to say. And you can, you know, manipulate numbers to back that up. I'll give you an example. The recent unemployment numbers, I believe the unemployment number for November showed, I believe, you know, the economy created about 150,000 jobs or so. That number might, but it's some sort of increase, right? But what they did is they, quote, seasonally adjusted those numbers to account for the devastation caused by Hurricane Sandy instead of a massive increase in unemployment, which was actually the case. You know, the hurricane caused, I think, 300,000 or 400,000 workers to either not go to work that month or only to work part time. it actually showed like a decrease in the unemployment rate, which is completely divorced from reality. Also, you know, the way that they calculate unemployment numbers, for instance, is also, you know, completely false. Like if you've been unemployed for longer than 6 months, then you're a, quote, discouraged worker and you're no longer counted in the unemployment rate. So we always have to be skeptical and look a little bit further into any of the numbers that we see from government sources, the Congressional Budgeting Office, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, places like that.
Can you detail what this issue is going to mean for young people?
Young people are going to be hit very hard by this deal. We know that just by looking at the taxation half of the agreement. Pell Grants is one of the very important federal programs that help a lot of working class youth get a higher education. There are also loans that a lot of people rely on, you know, including myself. There's also just the issue of the youth unemployment crisis. I believe youth unemployment rate in the United States, which is the unemployment rate for people under the age of 25, is 16%. And it's a lot worse for Black and Latino youth. This deal, the fiscal cliff deal, is going to greatly exacerbate that crisis. What the cuts to Social Security and Medicare especially are going to do by, you know, attacking older workers is going to force people to stay in the workforce a lot longer and basically, you know, allow capitalists to squeeze extra profit to exploit workers for longer. So in addition to being, you know, a horrible crime against, you know, elders in this society, it's also going to mean that there are a lot less job openings for young people. And that's going to, you know, increase that youth unemployment crisis, which is something that's going to not just affect people when they're young. It's not like, you know, when people turn 25, suddenly there's these, you know, wide range of job opportunities, but it's really going to stunt the development of people's lives, basically. You know, they're going to have to put off things like getting married, for instance. A lot of young people are just, you know, not starting families because they can't find a job. So I think that this deal is going to continue the current crisis that people are feeling just because of the contradictions of the capitalist system, and exacerbate that by shifting the burden of the crisis from Wall Street, which caused the crisis, onto the working class as a whole, especially the young and the older workers.
Do you see opportunities for intergenerational solidarity? Because in addition, as you pointed out earlier, Medicare, Medicaid are also going to be hit, affecting older Americans, but certainly a lot of young people are going to be impacted by the financial aid cuts that are expected to happen.
It's absolutely essential that, you know, when we're facing these cuts, that we adopt the principle of solidarity and really take that as a value. Any attack on any section of the working class is an attack against all working people. I think in particular, as it relates to intergenerational solidarity, we can take a lesson from the massive demonstrations in France in 2010. So basically, you know, the right-wing Sarkozy government in France announced a plan to increase the retirement age from 65 to 67. In response, you know, there were rolling general strikes throughout the country. There are millions of people on the streets. And you would expect when the issue is, you know, raising the retirement age from 65 to 67, it would be mostly older workers on the streets. But that wasn't the case. Hundreds of thousands of young French workers and French students took to the streets to defeat this proposal because they knew the attacks on older workers would be in addition to an immediate attack on younger workers in terms of exacerbating the youth unemployment crisis would lead to even greater and more intensified attacks on other sections of the working class later on. And so, you know, they engage in very militant struggles. You know, in 400 different French high schools, there were barricades put up. You know, French high school students fought battles with riot police all over the struggle to stop the increase of the retirement age. So I think that's, you know, a very important model for us to take to heart here in the United States. And I think we can absolutely reproduce that kind of militant struggle if we break with this idea of supporting the Democrats, working within the system, being quote unquote reasonable.
What are some pro-worker alternatives to this issue of budget deficits and crisis?
It's completely false to think that the country is broke or we're going bankrupt. That kind of like crisis rhetoric should be totally rejected because, in fact, you know, this is the richest society in human history. $15 trillion or something is the United States GDP. The problem is that that money and that wealth and the creation of that wealth is controlled by a tiny, tiny clique of bankers and CEOs called the capitalist class. We've heard some solutions from, you know, liberal commentators like Robert Reich that there should be maybe a financial transaction tax that, you know, whenever stock is sold or a derivative swapped on Wall Street, there's, you know, a tax on that transaction that can help pay for social programs or close the budget deficit. Or there have been proposals to have, you know, like actually meaningful taxes on the wealthy, like, you know, doubling the capital gains tax or greatly increasing the income tax on the highest income brackets. And those are all, you know, very good progressive things that we should support. But I think the real solution to this problem is to seize the banks. You know, the biggest financial institutions in this country are sitting on approximately $1.4 trillion of, quote, excess cash. And by excess cash, they mean money that they could be investing but are not investing because they don't have a sufficiently high enough rate of profit guaranteed under current economic conditions. That's absolutely criminal when, you know, so many millions of people are unemployed, so many millions of people are suffering because of poor economic conditions, that the bankers and CEOs can go essentially on strike, that essentially we're dealing with a capital strike. And the way to solve that is to take the big banks and financial institutions that are responsible for this economic crisis in the first place under the ownership, the democratic ownership of poor and working class people. So that would free up tremendous amount of assets. You know, we could merge the big banks, the big capitalist banks, into a publicly owned people's bank under the democratic management of community organizations, unions, women's organizations, student federations, and other, you know, environmental groups and other organizations that represent the interests of different sections of the working class. And we can use that wealth of society that poor and working people create in the first place to meet human needs. So that could be, you know, reducing the budget deficit. It could also be making sure that everybody has the right to health care and the right to an education. It could be eliminating unemployment, which would make, you know, the federal budget deficit like not a very big deal. If everybody was employed, that would dramatically turn around the fiscal situation in this country. So I think that the real solution to both the fiscal cliff dilemma and the economic crisis as a whole is to seize the banks.
Walter, it's been great to get a chance to talk to you. Any final thoughts to share with listeners?
The mentality that we need to have going forward is that the only thing that can dramatically turn around this situation is the massive and militant intervention of poor and working class people. We need to do that on the basis of rejecting this idea that the only way to solve this fiscal crisis is by cutting the vital social programs that poor and working class people rely on. And instead, we have to force the bankers, the CEOs, the rich, the ones responsible for this economic crisis, to pay for all the suffering that they've caused, and not just redistribute the already existing wealth of society, but to actually change the balance of power, to have power for poor and working class people rather than a tiny handful of bankers and CEOs, of millionaires and billionaires. And to do that, poor and working people have to have independent organizations. We have to break with the Democratic Party. We have to adopt the orientation that the only way forward, the only way that poor and working class people have ever won anything under the system called capitalism is through struggle, and that's the way forward.
Walter Smolarek is a journalist and organizer. His coverage of the fiscal cliff can be read at liberationnews.org. He joined the program via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And that's all for this edition of Liberation Radio. I'm Ernesto Aguilar, inviting you to tune in again for more coverage of the struggle for justice.
You have been listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Some of what you heard during this program are Creative Commons licensed compositions. Our theme music and some music segments were performed by Six Fingers and used with permission of the artist. Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation to help build the struggle for socialism in the United States. The PSL is a party of activists and organizers. We are in the streets at the demonstrations and picket lines, opposing cutbacks and attacks on workers, standing up to police brutality, fighting for immigrant rights, and struggling against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry. We stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world resisting imperialism. We believe the crimes of capitalism call for a new kind of society, and we are committed to fighting for it. Visit pslweb.org to find a PSL branch near you. See our upcoming events and learn more about how you can get involved. Again, that's pslweb.org. Also, check out the PSL's Liberation newspaper online at liberationnews.org, where you can read our news articles and analysis or purchase a subscription to their print edition. Thank you for listening. But when I leave, you remember I said...